Okay, so my name is Natalia Perkins, and I'm also from Minnesota. Now it's like invasion of Minnesota into Santa Barbara. And first of all, I would like to thank the organizer for organizing this beautiful meeting and also for possibility to speak. So I will continue actually about talking about the continuum of excitation, but now we'll talk in particular about quantum spin liquids. And basically, ce n'est pas un chapeau, and you see that I think it's very well fit with the title of the workshop. So it's really intertwined, the chapeau and the elephant. So, okay. So I try to follow the suggestion from Aries and try to speak about one work. I would slightly deviate from the plan. So basically, I will be talking mostly about Riggs, how Riggs works, and probe continuum of excitation. And that work was done in collaboration with Gaber Hausch, who is in principle here in KITP, Jeroen van der Brink, and Bram Perot, who was in University of Minnesota. But some earlier work, which I will mention, was done in collaboration with Fiona, Johannes, Dima, Roderick Mersner, and Jerry Chapson. Okay, so basically, I will talk directly about quantum spin liquids. And just to set up the definition, so quantum spin liquid is a state of interacting spins that breaks no rotational or translational symmetry and has probably only a short-range spin correlation, or probably only nearest neighbor spin correlation. And basically, what you need to realize this state is a strong interaction, strong quantum fluctuations, some frustration, low dimensionality that all helps to reach this state. And basically, many things start from the original proposed by Anderson about the resonating valence bond, which is basically one of the prototype of the modern quantum spin liquid. Okay, so what is important, what differs quantum spin liquid from magnetically ordered states, that there is no local order parameter, and therefore it's very difficult to probe the quantum spin liquid, because basically their characteristics such as, such as topological order and some long-range entanglement, that's very difficult to be probed experimentally. However, so quantum spin liquid as a strong quantum state supports excitation, and these excitations are very special, so they can be characterized by a fractional quantum number and very specific, maybe anionic statistic. And looking to the excitation, we can say actually a lot about quantum spin liquid. Very simple way to show what is fractionalized excitation is basically looking to spin 1/2 Heisenberg model, so on 1D, and basically what you do, you take one spin, you flip it, and by this you create two domain walls, and they can be separated in time, and then you can call this excitation as spin-out. So as I said, and actually not me, but it was Yongbai Kim who said that he is very surprised that there are so many quantum spin liquids and also found in nature. But yes, there are very many and they're actually very different. So it's not one state of matter. There are topological gapped quantum spin liquids and they can be realized in quantum dimer models and in a toric-code model. There are quantum spin liquids which are characterized by spin on Fermi surface, like for example on this compound with a triangle lattice. And there is the variety of Kitaev quantum spin liquids. They can be gapless or gapped. And basically the Kitaev spin liquid is a very special class of spin liquids because this exact solution exists and that helps us to study this liquid experimentally. Unfortunately, we don't have any true realization of Kitaev spin liquids here. And it's interesting that this Kitaev spin liquids can be realized both in two dimension and in three dimension, and that actually be the subject of my talk. And there was a hope, and maybe there is still a hope, that there is a quantum spin liquid in quantum spin ice materials, but we just need to find the proper material. So, okay, so basically the main question which I will try to answer in my talk is how to probe quantum spin liquids and their statistics and take home messages, look to excitation, and basically all these dynamical probes will work. So we can shed both light, X-ray, neutrons, maybe electrons to the quantum spin liquids. Then they will hopefully excite some fractionalized excitation if there is coupling between this external probe and this excitation. And basically that's how we can learn something. And it's basically two photon or two neutron approach. Okay, so what is important if we are talking about fractionalized excitation, that quantum spin liquid will always produce the multiparticle continuum, because since excitation carry a fractional quantum number, then relative to the local degrees of freedom, for example, spin flip, then only multiple quasiparticles can couple to external probe, because the magnon, the true spin flip will be, for example, characterized by S equal 1, while each of these fractionalized excitation can carry spin 1/2. Okay, and what is important that there are very different continuum, and basically we need to know how to characterize them. It can be like this, like that, or it can be sent, whatever. So basically the idea, we need to know the shape and we need to know what are the constituents of this continuum to be able to say something definite about the state of quantum spin liquid. And for that, it would be very nice to have a quantitative agreement between the theory and experiment, which actually was achieved very beautifully in a one-dimensional system. For example, this one-half Heisenberg antiferromagnetic chains, which I was talking about. So in this compound, and it's copper sulfides, and then something, so I already forgot what is the name of this compound. But in any case, because in 1D there are exact solutions, there's beta ansatz, then you can really quantitatively compare what you measure and what you compute, and looking to this plot, you say, okay, it's a perfect, not only qualitative, but quantitative agreement. There is another work, so there's different one-dimensional compound, and again, the beta ansatz solution give you very nice quantitative agreement between theory and experiment. However, if you are going away from one dimension, then basically we have somehow kind of poor understanding of the quantum spin liquids, and the main result that there is no exact method which works, and basically we can rely only on numerics or on some approximations which are quite often uncontrolled, and if you really want to achieve some quantitative agreements, then that might be difficult. So in that case, as I said, cation spin liquid is the paradise, because exact solution exists not only in two dimensions but also in three dimensions. So basically, that's the place where we can compute and compare with experiment, if experiment really realizes this cation spin liquid, but not yet. Okay, so cation model, I don't need to introduce, I'm sure that people know, but just in case to set up the notation. So that was first introduced for the honeycomb lattice, so three coordinated lattice where in blue, red, and green, three different components of spins are interacting, so it's Ising model with different components interacting on different boards. And this is exactly solvable two-dimensional model. The ground state is quantum spin liquid, and it supports fractionalized excitations. Basically, the way how Kitaev solved it, he mapped the spin to Majorana fermion. So here is the mapping to Majorana fermions. And then, because this model has a large number of conserved quantity, so you can basically look to each of the hexagon, and you can multiply the spin components around this hexagon such that in each vertex, you're taking the component of spin corresponding to outgoing bonds. So for this, it would be sigma z, for example. And all this quantity for each of the loop, for each of the hexagon compute with the Hamiltonian. And moreover, this Plaquette operator, they commute in between. So all the eigen states, all the Hilbert space can be separated to they can be characterized by the values at each hexagon plus minus one, and that would basically set the flux configuration. Now, so once we know this flux configuration, actually one can show that Kitaev model always maps to quadratic Hamiltonian for two of these Majorana fermions C. So, and therefore it can be exactly solved. So basically the reason, so basically what is done is the spin operators are rewritten in terms of the Majorana fermions, and then the bond fermions, which has a spin index, okay, so they form the bond variables U, and these U variables are also static, and that actually corresponds to the fact that these Plaquette operators are conserved quantities. Okay, so this is just the average number. So now basically what we can do, we can put for U different values of plus minus one, we will fix some flux sector, and in each of the flux sector, we can solve the Hamiltonian for Majorana fermion, both in ground state and in the excited state. So we know everything about the model. Okay, so what are the excitation of Kitaev model? So this is the famous triangle. Basically, the excitations for Majorana fermions can be both gapped and gapless, depending on the ratio of the parameters. So if you're close to the point where all the interactional free bonds are equal to each other, so isotropic points, then you have a gapless spin liquid, and the excitation which corresponds to going from one flux sector to another, these excitations are always gap. So basically, okay, for 2D, so it's not necessarily Majorana Fermi surface in 2D, it's just two points, but we see these gapless excitations. Okay, so interesting, but Kitaev model is also exactly solvable in 3D, and there is a whole class of Kitaev materials. What you actually need in 3D, you need that each side has three nearest neighbor bonds, and that these bonds are equidistant, and basically that angle between these modes are 120 degrees, or close to 120 degrees. And this is one series of the Kitaev materials, so based on the hexagons, this is so-called the hyper-honeycomb lattices, this is the two-dimensional hyper-honeycomb lattice, and this is H0 and H1 for the sector. Why these two are important are basically because they are real materials which corresponds to these two lattices. But there are other three-dimensional systems, also free-coordinated, so they belong to Kitaev family, like this one, for example, hyper-hexagon, and this one, hyper-octagon, and for them, we still don't have some experimental realization. There are more of them. So, and once again, the motivation starts from that there are already some experimental realizations, there are some real materials which are probably not in the Kitaev spin liquid phase, but at least there is a hope that all of these materials has dominant Kitaev interaction, and therefore they are somehow close to Kitaev spin liquid phase. So, and one of the compounds which is heavily studied nowadays is this alpha ruthenium chloride, and Hanke will be talking particularly about this compound next week. And there's this beta and gamma iridate, and basically Rado did extensive work for both of these compounds. Okay, so why we are interested in three-dimensional realization? Basically because when we look to this Majorana fermion band structure, they can have very different and very interesting band structure depending on the combination of time reversal and inversion symmetry, and also depending if the time reversal in the k-space should be supplied by some shift of the wave vector. So this lattice, this hyper-honeycomb lattice, which corresponds to beta iridate, if you compute the spectrum, then it has this nodal line. So basically, instead of Dirac cone, which you have in two dimension, you have the line, and each point of this line corresponds to this Dirac cone. So excitations are gapless on this line. Then there's another system. So this is hyper-octagon lattice, and that was first discussed by Maria Hermans and Simon Trebs. And basically, this lattice is interesting because now Majorana fermions, the band structure of Majorana fermions, will be really characterized by the Fermi surfaces. And Another system, this hyperhexagon lattice. So in this lattice, it will be only the set of discrete points at which the spectrum is gapless, and this is this gapless while point. So you see that the nodal structure for these three-dimensional compounds is very different, and the question is, can we actually see it in experiment? So, and then the spectroscopy of K-type liquids comes. So, and basically the method which I briefly want to discuss is the inelastic neutron scattering, but just to give you results, then Raman scattering, and I will be mostly discussing what we can see in resonant X-ray scattering in K-type spin liquids. So, inelastic neutron scattering, actually the first work was proposed theoretically by Her Highness Knolly, Kavrijan, Chokhi, and Mercer in 2014, and they showed that because of the exact solution, the dynamical structure factor for this spin liquid can be computed exactly. Okay? And basically, whenever neutron is coming, since it's corresponding to spin flip, then it will be always basically two fluxes will be created. So the measurement of dynamic structure factor leads to a sudden insertion of a pair of two Z2 gauge fluxes. So since the flux sector is always gap, flux excitations are always gap, then they showed that there will be some gap for the dynamical structure factor. So in neutron scattering, you will always see the gap because you always create some fluxes, and on top of that, you can excite some Majorana fermions. And basically in this ruthenium chloride mentioned before, so that was the theoretical prediction, and this is the experimental results. So sorry, I forgot to put the reference. Basically, some features of fractionalized excitations are visible. The question is this continuum here coming from the Majorana fermions, or you can explain it this in terms of multi-magnon continuum remains open, but in any case, the theoretical and experimental results at least qualitatively agree.
You said before that there's no real life realization of the liquid. So there's probably some
Heisenberg. There are other interactions. So what is important is that it, also in this compound, the K-type interaction is the dominant interaction. So basically, at low temperature, it shows long-range magnetic orders, exact magnetic order. But if you are close to K-type spin liquid, and if you are probing basically high energy excitations, then you can still hope that you see some features coming from the K-type spin liquid.
The theory is for pure K-type.
This theory is for pure K-type. One can perturbatively add some other interactions in this compound. Probably Heisenberg interaction is not the most important perturbation, but this gamma term, which Rado was talking in a different context, is probably important. And I still don't think that, so there is qualitative agreement, but I don't think that anybody reached a quantitative agreement so far.
Sorry, Natasha, the theory calculation on the left is some version of the Knolle et al.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You have the spin gap at the bottom, but on the right, it looks like high intensity at the bottom. I'm missing something. On the experiment.
There will be still some gap.
Yeah.
And then will be some low intensity. Yes.
Experiment doesn't.
No.
Experiment is. Maybe I comment here. So
okay,
the,
please.
The zero energy, strong intensity.
Yeah.
That has got nothing to do with the physics.
That's just.
It's neutron scattering coherent.
You mean here?
Yeah.
Trial start.
So I should just subtract that.
Yeah.
So I can't say anything about a gap.
No.
Probably.
Well, the experiments do show a gap, you know, this A scan there, the A point, there is a gap there. But that's believed to be due to additional terms in the Hamiltonian, so-called gamma term, that opens a gap and helps stabilize the magnetic order. So
I think their claim here was that they was able to somehow reproduce the high energy feature, some temperature dependence of this feature, and some angular resolution of this feature. So basically, that was the claim how they copied. But then it was just, so it was a recent work by Stephen Winter and Roser Valenti. 5 minutes, yes. I didn't reach the RICS yet. So what I want to say that basically, it can be also some sort of multi-magnon.
Good.
if this was a purity type, what kind of spin liquid would it be? Would it be gapped or gapless?
Most likely, but gapless, yes. The gapless. Gapless spin liquid. But in neutron scattering, you always create a flux, so whatever response you will see, the response will always be gapped. Okay, so the chairman saying they have only 5 minutes, so what I want to say very quickly that, okay, there is also Raman spectroscopy, so, and basically it's two photon process, photon in, photon out, and what is important here is that since the Raman operator can be, so this is the form of the Raman operator, which can be written in the spin operators, so it's the same super exchange, but which is photo-induced, which is induced by the incoming photon. So you see that here you do the standard trick, and you see that you have a quadratic Hamiltonian. So Raman operator itself does not induce any fluxes. And basically, in Raman, whatever you will see, that will be the measuring of excitations of Majorana fermions in the ground state or in the ground state of the model. And basically what we look to Kitaev model in 2D and 3D, and we showed, so we computed analytically this, basically the continuum, and we see that if we're in isotropic point, then response is polarization independent, and you see that it's gapless, and it's gapless because the Majorana fermions has gapless spectrum, and if it's gapped, so if we are in the anisotropic point, if we are inside the triangle, it's still gapless, but now it acquires some polarization dependence. And if we are going away of this triangle, then the response will also be gapped. But what is important that in both cases, we are probing directly the Majorana fermion spectrum. So, and basically, once again, the same compound, the group of Ken Birch was measuring Raman scattering, and they were identifying some continuum here. And basically comparing this, the feature of this bump with our calculations. So once again, some signature fractalizations are visible in ruthenium chloride. So there are three-dimensional compounds with these very complicated lattices. And basically in each of these lattices, even structurally, you have multiple sublattices. So for example, in H naught and H beta, in these two phases, you have either four or eight sublattices. So what you get immediately, you have a very complicated continuum here, so response. And basically, you see that there is a polarization dependence because of this sublattice structure. And once again, so it was some measurement of Raman spectrum by Peter Lehmann's group in the gamma lithium iridate. And there is some, at least qualitative, feature which we predict for this type of compounds, so different polarization in AC and AB polarization was seen, and there is again a continuum in this compound. But in any case, whenever it's Raman scattering, so basically you create two Majorana fermions, but the transfer momentum in the Raman scattering is Q equal to zero. So by this, by Raman scattering, you're not probing the whole continuum, but only the part of the continuum when you create two Majorana fermions which k and with k and minus k moment, and that basically comes why the weak spectroscopy can be very useful, because it can give you some resolution of the continuum in the momentum space, and also it can give you some additional information similar to the neutron scattering. So once again, in brief, weak spectroscopy is the following one. It's again two photon process, so photon coming, but because it's X-ray photon, it has a lot of energy, it's taking electron from some deep level, create the core hole here, and they bring electron to the valence bond. So this intermediate state is not very stable, and basically the decay is happening very quickly. And if we want to see how RICS would work for iridium 4+, for example, then what we have that this intermediate state, when you take the core electron and bring it to 5D level, you are actually creating the non-magnetic vacancy. So what you have in the intermediate state, you have Kitaev model in which in one side, it looks like the spin is taking out. And basically that was studied in detail by Gaber Hauers, John Jolke, and Redrich Mössner. And the idea is how to, or how one can study this model is that if you have a vacancy, then basically you still have exact solution. You cannot do it doing Fourier transform, but you still have a matrix and you can diagonalize it exactly. So the idea is the following. You take this site where the electron is coming, this vacancy, and basically what you say that let's switch off this coupling between the vacancy and the nearest neighbor site. And there is a certain description of this vacancy, just a convenient formalism. What is convenient for excitation is always assume that this artificial spin here is always pointing up. But that is detail. So now we can compute the Rieks amplitude for this model, and this is the general formula. So this is a Cramer's Heisenberg formula. So you start with the ground state, you take this D operator corresponds to bringing the core electron up, and then this N tilde is this intermediate state. Okay. So what is next important is that for LH, you can do the polarization analysis, and you can see that the polarization tensor can be decomposed like this. So basically, one component of this would be such that during the Rieks process, the spin in the valence band is not changing, so that would be spin conserving channel, and this would be like A1G channel, so this would be just a scalar product of polarization, and then it would be free spin non-conserving channels, which are proportional to Pauli matrices. Okay, so now when we have these four fundamental Rieks channel, then what is important, we can rewrite our amplitude in this form, and gamma is the inverse lifetime of the intermediate state. So, and what is important that this H tilde is the Kitaev Hamiltonian in the system with a vacancy, and it cannot create fluxes. So it's only this operator sigma, which stays here, can create fluxes. So basically, in the spin-conserving channel, this Pauli matrix is just identity matrix, so the fluxes are not created. But in the free non-spin-conserving channel, we have these sigma matrices here. That means that we are creating two fluxes depending on this component. So basically, in the final state now, we will have one of the three situations that we will have two fluxes here, or two fluxes here. So we will use a fast collision approximation. That means that we assume that the lifetime of the electron on the intermediate set is very short, and that this 1 over gamma is a very small number. And then we can just write what is the lowest order in the Rieks amplitude. Okay, so this is this expression. So now we can see that if we're looking to the non-spin conserving channel, then we can completely neglect this one. And basically, what we will have is nothing else as sigma operator here. So we can completely, I said wrongly, we can completely neglect this term. And then what we have here is nothing else as the matrix element for inelastic neutron scattering. So basically, this channel will show you exactly the same as inelastic neutron scattering. So you will have very little dispersion, and you will have always the finite gap.
This is A2.
A2.
I mean, as opposed to A1, which is non-spin.
This is, so, okay. So basically, non-spin conserving is when you have fluxes.
Theory wise, that was A1, this one,
that is one of these.
A2, which is A.
It will be triplet. No, it will be triplet. So it would not be A2. We can talk about this later. So, what I want to show is basically, I want to show some result. We can also look to the spin conserving channel. Okay? So, and the spin conserving channel, basically, we need to take this second term into account, because if we keep only this term, then we will have elastic response because there is no sigma operator here. Okay, so in this case, our final state, so in the final state, we can have a different situation. We can have no flux and two fermion excitations, okay, in the inelastic term. And once again, this is intensity. Let me show, I understand that my time is over, but this is the general expression for intensity. And this last term is coming from the interference between A and B sublattices, since the honeycomb lattice is not a Bravais lattice, so you will always have this interference term coming into intensity. So if we look to response in 2D, in spin-conserving channel, then you can see that we have the gapless response in a discrete number of points, in the K points, which corresponds to the Dirac cones, and in the gamma point. Okay, so basically, in these two particular points, there is also a zero coming from this factor. It's very strong zero. However, if we are going to the gapped phase, then our response will also be gapped. So this picture is computed. This is basically frequency, and this is Q vector along the symmetry direction in the Brillouin zone. And the color corresponds to intensity. So this plot is a way of the symmetric plot. But when we go to 3D lattices, so now we can see all the variety of the band structures for this 3D cation spin liquids, which I showed before. So we can have Dirac lines, and then we have gapless points and the Fermi surface. So if we look to this hyperhoneycomb lattice, which is characterized by this nodal line in the plane, in this gamma xy plane, then we see, so here this white dot shows the region below which we have zero intensity, because the colors are such that probably it can be confused. So we see that almost everywhere we have gapless response except some particular region. So here we have gapped response only. If we have only gapless excitation at a discrete number of wild points, then again, so we'll have gapless excitation only in the discrete number of points, and everywhere in the generic points of the Brillouin zone, we'll have only gapped excitation. And for hyper octagon lattice, which is characterized by the Fermi surfaces, basically there is multiple ways how we can take the gapless fermions from these Fermi surfaces, and we see that we have almost everywhere we have a gapless response. And I'm done. So basically, what I want to say that I was talking about Kitaev model exactly. We can look for some perturbation. High energy features would be robust, even if we introduce some perturbation. But of course, low energy features, they can be completely different from what I showed, which was computed for the pure Kitaev point. And once again, in order to see which features are robust and which are not, it's like important to see to the structure of intensity and which term will be affected by perturbation and which term will not be affected by perturbations. Thank you. And sorry for taking long.
The hole, is it mobile?
No. So in principle, it can be mobile. But in this fast collision approximation, so because it's a very short leaf, so it can be a situation when we can look when it's mobile. But in this approximation, it's completely static hole.
Naive equation. So one is Riggs versus Raman. The Hamiltonian is the same.
Yes.
Do we need two theories, or one is enough? Or we just take the limit of frequencies?
It's not the limit of frequencies. It's basically the energy of incoming photon, which is different.
Oh,
so, okay. Frequency, you mean by this. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, in a sense,
it's the same,
yes.
Formalism.
It's the same formalism. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that is like effective theory when the wavelength is very long and the energy is small.
And something which I missed. As far as I understood, you had Raman response in the XX polarization and also an XY.
It depends. Yeah, we were looking for different polarizations. So if you are in the like Kitaev model in honeycomb lattice, then its polarization depends. You can take whatever polarization you want. And then you can be changing polarization in order to see some different modes.
Why would you be seeing magnetic excitations in an XX polarization when the plane collision is at the upper peak.
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Naive question. I think of Raman as something, you know, useful for probing phonons.
It is useful for probing. It's whatever excitation you create, if it couples, so, then it's useful. So
So now when I looked at the data, there were lots of peaks. The experimental
that's
data.
All magnetic excitation. So
those
it's
are all magnetic.
We do not consider phonons at all. And usually, if you look to the frequencies at which you will see it, they're quite well separated. Not always, but quite often. So magnetic peaks and the phonon peaks will be in different energy scales. And it's also often that the phonon peaks will be very, very sharp, while here we are seeing really the continuum features.
But was there an experiment theory comparison in your presentation?
Yes, but then they already subtract. It was not really like, it's just that they see something similar, but they already subtract the phonon contribution. Okay. They're looking only to magnetic excitation.
The experimental data seem to have a lot more structure than the continuum.
It has a lot of structure, but like the phonon peaks, most of the phonon peaks in this picture were already subtracted by experimenters.
You can account for all the features,
no,
the data.
No. And that's actually tell us that in any case, so there is a continuum. We are not in the spin-liquid phase, but only nearby. So some features of the Kitai spin-liquid can be seen, but because all materials are magnetically ordered, then there are other features which are present, which cannot be accounted, at least in this theory.
Outside of those.
I just want to make sure I understand what you meant by a generic Kitai spin liquid. So the astronomy iridate system that people thought was a Kitai system for a long time, there are obviously some terms which make it deviate in some respect strongly from that. Is that what you would still call a Kitai spin liquid in the sense that the high energy features would still...
It's actually coming from this paper, this name for generic Kitai spin liquid, but the idea is, so Kitai spin liquid is stable with respect to perturbation.
Yeah.
But this region is very narrow. So then the Kitai spin liquid breaks and you always go to some magnetically ordered phase, which can be still close to Kitai spin liquid. So this is more about the features of the Kitai spin liquid away from exactly solvable point.
Right. But is strontium iridate such a system?
Sodium iridate, or which one? Sodium iridate, I think
sodium
is...
Iridate.
So sodium iridate is
sodium
very
iridate.
Far from Kitai spin liquid.
Okay,
ruthenium chloride is probably very close.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let's take the question.